PwC has come out with its 10th Executive Director's Practices and Remuneration Report. It's found that more work is being done to try and ensure fairer pay at an executive level and noted heightened sensitivity around executive pay in light of recent corporate scandals. Well, to take us through the report and some of its findings, I'm joined on the line by Leila Ebrahimi. She's an Associate Director at PwC. So, Leila, globally, what are the report's main observations in terms of executive director remuneration package trends?
Okay, so what we've observed is that, generally speaking, South African executives are being paid less in terms of increases. So we're seeing a level of, hesitance to apply large increases, particularly with CEOs. So we've pleasantly observed that the increased percentages for CEOs have been less than our global counterparts. And we would say that globally speaking, the South African executive remuneration is less than, well, it's not as extreme as we observe, particularly within the FTSE companies and within the US.
So now executive remuneration has really caught the attention of ordinary folk around the world. This as the world seemingly becomes increasingly more unequal. What sort of conversations are being had around the issue of fair pay and what practical initiatives are actually being practiced?
So we're seeing an increased responsibility on the remuneration committees in this regard, particularly with King IV coming into play. There's definitely more conversations being had around the boardroom table surrounding what is fair pay, what are ethical remuneration practices. And in this regard, we haven't seen much action, to be honest with you. It's more, at the moment, conversation. So what we're seeing is remuneration committees asking the questions of, are we paying fairly? Are we paying ethically? What do those things mean? And what is fairness and ethical pay practice for us within our specific organization? Then they're asking the questions of, in terms of how do we analyze actually what our practices are, how do we assess them, and who do we compare ourselves to, or what is the norm? Once they've done that analysis, they're then struggling with the idea of how do we disclose this, and are our peer companies disclosing this, and how is this going to look in the media if we do disclose this, particularly with no comparative norms out there.
What's the trend in terms of executives being remunerated according to their performance? Because often people feel hard done by the fact that executives sometimes just do as well as the company does in terms of its market cap, as opposed to what they've actually done themselves to bring benefits to the company.
We're seeing a strong pay for performance insistence from our asset managers and institutional investors. And this is definitely where we see the shareholder activism picking up within South Africa. So we did lag the international trend quite a bit in this regard, but now we're seeing shareholders standing up and saying, demonstrate to us that the pay that you've given to this executive is strongly linked to their performance during the year. And this is where the new single figure reporting in terms of King IV comes in. So the new director's emoluments table disclosure actually sets out how pay during the year, both in terms of total guaranteed package, short-term incentives or bonuses as they're commonly called, and the long-term incentives, share options or full shares as they might be, how they are linked to performance during the reporting year. So it aims to actually give you one single figure that represents those three components together that is linked to that performance year.
I was going to say that I see that in the South African context, since you're talking about that, there's now a trend, or at least according to JSC principles, if you're a JSC listed company, you now have to speak to your shareholders about the remuneration structure and what the plan is, and they're able to vote on it, but it's not necessarily binding. I mean, so what's the point with that?
So because we have King IV, which is the corporate governance code, and it's not actually legislation within South Africa, we weren't able, or it wasn't considered appropriate, to bring in the binding vote as they have, for instance, in the UK, where the company publishes its remuneration policy, and then there's a binding vote from the shareholders, and only if they get the requisite number of votes are they allowed to pay according to that policy. So with King IV, we saw a non-binding vote. The difference from the previous dispensation under King III is that the vote is now split between the remuneration policy and the implementation report. And what that means is that the institutional investors and the shareholders can actually say, I'm happy with the way you pay, so that's your remuneration policy, happy with what you are intending to do, I'm happy with the policy, and they can vote there. But they could, for instance, say that they're not happy with how you've paid during the reporting year. So in other words, the application of the policy, and that comes through in the implementation report. So the idea there is to try and separate the views of the shareholders relating to whether they're comfortable or not with the policy and how you intend to pay versus how you actually paid during the year. And the thinking there is that although we don't have the binding vote, there's greater accountability that comes with that greater transparency. And there's obviously the requirement now to publish your engagement with your shareholders. So when you've had the negative vote to 25% or more, what have you done to engage with your shareholders and how have you addressed the concerns that have been raised through the shareholder engagement process?
So now, in a bid for fairer executive pay, there's also talk around ratio pay. Just tell us a bit about that. I mean, as we know that the ratio of executive pay against ordinary workers, certainly in the South African context, can be several hundred times. And this is in a country of extreme inequality.
So obviously that was one of the major debates with King IV, whether to bring in a gender pay ratio is then another thing that's on top of that. And the US has brought that in and made it a requirement to actually publish that ratio. And what we find is due to the number of ways that the ratio can be calculated, it's often not easy to compare between companies. For instance, you might have the CEO compared to the lowest paid worker. Other companies might do CEO compared to the average of all other workers. So it can be a bit difficult to interpret and therefore not that useful. So the idea is that by addressing the fair and ethical pay requirements or the responsibilities placed on the remuneration committee to actually take those considerations seriously and address those through a required policy and disclosure, that the requirement for a pay ratio might be negated, or that might actually be more constructive than actually just disclosing a number.
It's interesting. You beat me to it. I was going to talk about gender parity a little bit later, but whilst we're on it, let's talk about it. What's happening in that area when it comes to pay? Is that picture improving? And I do see that in some European jurisdictions, they seem to be leading the charge on that one. It escapes my mind, but I know one country has decided that there must be equal pay for men and women in that particular European country, which is very progressive.
Yes. So it's difficult to actually comment on that without first stating that the biggest problem is the number of women that are actually represented. So we're facing two challenges here. There is gender pay disparity, but there's also just a lack of gender diversity, you know, within organizations, particularly at board level. So there is some progress in terms of, well, not in terms of women being represented, but in terms of, for instance, the JSE requiring listed companies to have a policy in place and actually disclose on what they're doing in terms of gender diversity. In terms of progress in that regard, I mean, we have still 2.2% of our JSE listed companies have female CEOs, which is horrific. But then again, if you look at the Fortune 500, we're looking at 4.8% of female CEOs. So we're bad, but it's all relative. It seems everyone's bad at this stage.
Indeed. And then what about younger professionals entering the corporate world? Is there a benchmark there? And how, if at all, does a corporate take into account the official minimum wage in the country as they decide on that particular number?
So we found that the official minimum wage is not that useful, and we prefer to talk about the living wage, which I'm sure you would have seen in our report.
Yes.
So we've calculated internally the living wage, and you know, we're not as progressive as the UK in this regard, which actually has published a living wage and says, you know, this is what we believe the number to be. But according to our calculations, it sits somewhere around 10,000 to 12,000 rand monthly, and that living wage enables someone to live a frugal but dignified lifestyle. So we would say that that living wage is a more important number to talk about than the minimum wage, because that really is not enough to be living a frugal but dignified lifestyle. But in answer to your question about young professionals, interestingly, when we did our analysis and we looked at the gender total guaranteed pay median pay gap, we found that it ranged between 5 to 10%, which indicated that there wasn't as much of a gender pay gap within the median of a company. And if you think about how a company you know, how the pay grades might look. If you look at the median of the pay grades, you might find that your professionals with a few years' experience are sitting there. So we're finding that that's not where the problem actually lies within the organization. It's more at the lower levels than at the higher levels.
And then, Leila, in light of major corporate governance lapses, which in some cases have brought corporates close to their knees, what does King IV and company legislation say about the sanctions that can be brought to bear on executives who've been instrumental in this type of activity? It's a couple of questions as well. And is there a possibility to reclaim their overinflated pay packages if they fudged company financials to create a positive impression to shareholders, which would ultimately help boost the share price, which obviously executives would benefit from in instances where they have share options, for example?
Yes. So the most progressive thing we're seeing here is the introduction of malus and clawback policies. And it has been a very slow trend within South Africa, but we're definitely seeing it picking up now, obviously in light of recent corporate failures that we've observed and that have been very publicly, you know, observed. So if I can just quickly explain those terms, because I think they're used interchangeably sometimes. So malus would mean that a bonus payment that is about to be paid or has not yet been paid, or a long-term incentive which has not yet vested or been paid, can be withheld or stopped from vesting or being paid. So it's before the occurrence of the event. Whereas clawback means that something that has already been paid to an executive or has already vested can actually be clawed back. Mm. So that used to be done in the form of shares. Nowadays, the preference is to claw back the cash equivalent of the value that they received. So these are mechanisms through which executives can be held accountable, usually when those are invoked in the occurrence of certain trigger events, such as misstatement of financial statements, misconduct, gross misconduct, harm or risk management failures, such instances. But it does require a company to have a policy in place and to have contractually agreed with the executive that these mechanisms will be applied. They can't just be applied. It's not within our Companies Act. It's not legislated. It is something that will need to be voluntarily agreed between employer and employee.
Mm. And then I want to take you to a place maybe where you may feel a little bit uncomfortable, because you've been focusing on the report, but based on your knowledge of the law, you know, when you look at a case like Steinhoff, for example, do you think ultimately people should be brought to book and ultimately, you know, do some jail time?
That is not a place that I definitely feel comfortable. But I think jail time is one thing. From my perspective and in my personal opinion, what's more important is allowing the company to recover some of its losses. And that's why we heavily punt the introduction of malus and clawback, with the idea that you shouldn't have to invoke those provisions. They shouldn't be commonly invoked. It should be the very rare instance that you do have to invoke such things. But when you do have a massive corporate governance failure, you do have those mechanisms available to try and claw back some of the value, which is why it's so important that you have access to the cash value that was realized or the cash value that vested, rather than just the shares, because you might have a share price that's completely plummeted and those shares are actually worthless. So clawing them back is not going to recover any value.
That was Leila Ebrahimi. She's an associate director at PwC.